Future-proof extra from News Talk.
Now, we live in a society which has never been more open. We talk about our sex lives, reproduction, mental health, and everything in between. Very little is taboo. There are some things we still don't like to talk about, though, and menopause is one of them. Not only do we not like to talk about it, but the way in which we do mightn't give us the full picture. So what is menopause, and how can we better understand it from a scientific point of view? Well, Susan M. Patton is a distinguished research professor in the Department of History at the University of Georgia and author of The Slow Moon Climbs, The Science, History and Meaning of Menopause. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm happy to be here.
So what is a menopause from a scientific point of view?
Okay, well, there's actually several different ways to answer that question. So there's sort of three or four different ways I can answer this question of what is menopause, but I'll start with the easiest one. So the word menopause was coined in 1821 by a French doctor to describe a syndrome that up until that time starts to pop up in Western medical literature in around 1700 and is really poorly attested before that. But after 1700, becomes a big deal. And before that, and people started, in the beginning, doctors were calling it symptoms and diseases occurring in connection with the end of menstruation in women or something like that. So they'd have these long circumlocutions to describe this syndrome that they're trying to talk about. And so this physician, de Gardin, thought that was too awkward and coined this term to describe that syndrome. So in its origin, the word menopause really describes these sort of symptoms that are thought to accompany the end of menstruation. There's a couple other ways to answer the question, though, and one of the ones that I focus on in my book is that we can also think of menopause as the end of reproduction, and that's a very commonly understood meaning.
When we talk about the end of reproduction, are we, apart from eggs running out, is there something else? I mean, excuse my ignorance on this subject, but actually it's something I don't know a huge amount about. Is there something, are there other physical changes that happen in a woman's body as a result of this, is it running out of eggs that triggers a menopause?
Yes, the short answer is that's what's assumed today. It's actually kind of harder than you think to get answers to this kind of question because of the ways we have. There's sort of limitations on how much we can find out about what's going on in the ovaries of women without, you know, for example. But anyway, we think what happens is that as we get lower on eggs, one of the functions of eggs is to produce a lot of the reproductive of hormones.
Yeah.
Associated with reproduction. So what menopause is, the way we understand it starting in the early 20th century, we understand menopause as hormonal change. And basically the shutting down of the ovaries so that they no longer produce the hormones that are associated with reproductive life.
Right. And so can you take me through the processes that happen? I mean, when you lose your last egg, do other physical changes happen apart from hormone regulation?
Well, we don't necessarily lose all of them. Most doctors would say menopause happens when you sort of stop ovulating and stop menstruating around the time when you have about 1,000 eggs left. So it
seems like a lot of eggs.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the last egg. So yeah, what mostly happens is, yes, we stop ovulating, we stop menstruating, we stop being able to, we stop being fertile, we stop getting pregnant, which is a big deal. These are the obvious, you know, changes. And then, as I say, in our culture, what you may be asking about is in our culture, we also associate lots of other physical symptoms and changes with menopause.
Is that, I mean, obviously hormones are hugely important in regulating a lot of the things you're talking about, whether it's mental health or physiological homeostasis, so to speak, like just everything working normally. Does hormone replacement therapy, if it works, does it fix that?
Well, this is a really interesting question. I always tell people, you know, I'm not a doctor and I try not to get too much into the weeds of there's really a huge amount of medical research. And you can imagine why. I mean, there's a lot of money at stake in hormonal therapy and so on. But in the last chapters of my book, I do discuss how, you know, certainly when estrogen was discovered in the early 1920s and people realized, oh, menopause is partly a condition characterized by lower levels of ovarian estrogen or low levels of ovarian estrogen, or we no longer have that. And then, oh, it's also, you know, it's also thought to be associated with all these other things. Well, we'll give people estrogen and all this other stuff will go away. And by the way, estrogen will probably also be a wonder drug and an elixir of youth and so on. And I'm not sort of exaggerating the language that was used at the time. People really thought estrogen was going to be like insulin for diabetes, right? It was going to be this miracle drug. And that did not work out. So as most people know now, the Women's Health Initiative that was halted in the early 2000s really sort of was the last nail in the coffin of the idea is estrogen's going to fix all our problems. And what it turned out is that estrogen is protective against some things, increases risks of other things. Overall, the effects of all these things are small. By that time, people had already given up trying to treat depression, for example, with estrogen. They tried that for decades, and it just didn't work. Yeah. So
turns out mental health and women's reproductive health is slightly more complicated than previously thought by medical professionals, mostly men, during the 1960s. What a surprise. What about the uniqueness of this? I mean, does menopause happen across species?
Oh, yeah. So this is why it's important to talk about, again, these two sort of different understandings of what menopause means. But species, actually, I'll come back to that. So menopause, end of reproduction, and this, that what human women have, we have reproductive life stage, and then we have post-reproductive life stage. So we go on to live a few decades, actually, after we stop being able to reproduce. And you're asking, do other animals do that? And the answer is mostly no. There are two species that we know of where females outlive their reproductive lives by a very substantial margin. And those are both species of toothed whales. And the ones that listeners probably are most familiar with is the killer whales, the black and white orcas. This is a species that has been studied for decades and decades in these very rigorous demographic studies of pods of orcas off of the coast of Washington and British Columbia. And so we know, in fact, that female orcas stop reproducing around age 40, but they go on to live for decades longer than that. And we're not actually even sure how long, what is the average lifespan of an adult female orca. They're very long lived. Male orcas, not so much. It looks like male orcas neither have long lives nor long reproductive lives. They just they die much younger.
And I suppose our closest relative, the chimpanzee, do they have a long post-reproductive life in females?
No, they do not. In fact, they're quite conspicuously do not have that. Huh. Chimpanzees seem to have either no post-reproductive life stage to speak of, or they. It's not unusual in mammals that on average, we'll tend to outlive our reproductive lives a little bit, but not to the extent that human women, not by this very significant extent that we see in human women and in orcas.
But I mean, can we not explain why women are living longer beyond their menopause simply by looking at life expectancy over the past century? I mean, if we look at life expectancy in 1900 was 46, in 1950 was 64, and now it's 81. I mean, is this not just a happy offshoot from better living, better nutrition, and so on? That's why women are living much more beyond their menopause, or can we not attribute it to that?
We know that that's not the case, but that's a common question that I'm often asked because it does make sense in a way, right? And the problem there is that with the term average life expectancy. So yes, average life expectancy at birth is much longer in the modern period than it was in the pre-modern period, and in most places that transition happened in the 20th century. In pre-modern societies, average life expectancy at birth is about usually in the 20s, maybe in the 30s. However, those numbers are driven by high mortality in infancy and in childhood. So when demographers started looking, for example, at modern pop, there are some modern populations that don't have modern medicine, that don't have a lot of influence from modernization, and that have pre-modern demographic patterns. We also have pretty good records from some societies from before modernization and before the demographic transition. So we have pretty good evidence for what human life history was like before modernization.
Yeah.
And what scientists have found from looking very carefully at these records is that, again, as they say, we see high infant mortality, high child mortality. These actually are not that easy to explain in terms of theory, but, you know, that's its own complicated question. That the modal lifespan for an adult human, if you humans over 15 or over 20 or whatever we're looking for at adulthood, is maybe 70, 75 years.
Right.
A woman who has survived to age 45, which is, you know, probably not going to have any other children, has an average life expectancy in a pre-modern society of probably another 20, 25, even 30
right.
years.
Right, okay. That's actually really interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Then the sort of question comes to, why would they evolve this long lifespan beyond menopause? And there is a hypothesis, which I'm not sure I fully buy, but it's called the grandmother's hypothesis,
yes.
Right?
Yes, that's the most famous of the sort of evolutionary hypotheses of menopause, or the adaptive hypotheses of menopause. And there are others also that try to explain this in terms of evolution. And one thing that is becoming the consensus, again, as we know more and we're able to develop different measures for measuring really the length and the extent of post-reproductive life in women and in other animals, is that the consensus is that it probably is adaptive. It's getting harder and harder. It's harder to explain it in any other way. And the leading hypotheses are all adaptive hypotheses of menopause. And the grandmother hypothesis, which is developed by Kristen Hawkes at University of Utah starting in the late 1980s, is the most famous of those. So one of the foundations is the idea that we use energy for different things at different stage of life. So we use energy to grow. Then when we're done growing, we use that energy to reproduce. And then at some point we're done reproducing, and now we have this other. So what are we doing with that energy? The grandmother hypothesis interprets post-reproductive life as a sort of energy surplus for women. And what they're doing for that with that energy is investing it in their children and grandchildren, and especially in their grandchildren. So we take that energy that we were using to reproduce, and we plow it back into investing in our grandchildren. And that investment was so helpful that the grandchildren were more likely to survive, and our genes for longevity were passed on through those grandchildren.
So when my mom refuses to come over to the house, look after the kids, she is fighting her own genetic drive.
Well, that's the classic grandmother hypothesis. Really focuses on food provisioning, providing food, and to some extent childcare and other kinds of support. But the classic grandmother hypothesis is mostly about food. It's like we're taking that productivity and giving it to our grandchildren. However, more and more, we're realizing that there are so many ways that post-reproductive people use that energy to contribute to their own descendants or to other people in their group. And that turns out to be mathematically quite important for surprising ways. So just because you're not babysitting, your mother-in-law isn't babysitting, or she's not giving you food, right? There are many other ways that that energy is used productively, and that seems to be the reason why we evolved longer lives, but not longer reproductive lives, which is something that really should not happen unless, as I say, unless there's some kind of inclusive fitness benefit.
Well, it's a really interesting book. It's called The Slow Moon Climbs, The Science, History, and Meaning of Menopause. Susan Mattern, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.